This Week in Radio Tech is supported by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource, a reference for broadcast engineers, on the web at thebdr.net. And by Violet Microphones, handcrafted in Latvia for generations, on the web at violetusa.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Torrent.
You know, some guys will have literally hundreds of thousands of dollars involved in their hobby. For contesting. Yes, for contesting.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? Yeah, I have all your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
It's KD5FYD, W2TRR, and W9JOL. And we're joined by special guest NF4Alpha.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hello and welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. This is the podcast where we talk about all kinds of things that are radio oriented. Now that includes everything from the stylus on the turntable to the laser on the CD player to the hard drive in the automation playback system to the microphone, mic processing, audio consoles, routing and mixing around a studio, how to even build a studio, some of the things that we do to try to keep a studio quiet, unlike the studio I'm in now, which is a very reflective box. And then also we talk about RF, radio frequency transmission, and how radio waves get from here to there, how to amplify them, what they do, and how to care for them. And occasionally we venture off into parallel universes. Last week we did that with our show featuring James Spann, who's a TV meteorologist in Birmingham and also an amateur radio operator. We talked about how James uses amateur radio in his coverage of weather events in the Birmingham market. And we had a good success with that show, so we thought we'd bring another guest on the show to talk about amateur radio this evening. But first, let me introduce co-hosts for this show. First of all, I'm Kirk Harnack. That's me. I am the international sales director for the folks at Telos, Omnia, and Axia. And I also happen to be part owner of four radio stations. I own the part that doesn't make any money. I'm at one of those stations right now. This is the WROX Studios in Clarksdale, Mississippi, home of the blues, and with good reason. But one of my co-hosts, let's go to the Hudson Valley of New York, and that's Tom Ray, who's also an amateur himself. Hi, Tom.
And a ham in many other ways, too. But good evening, Kirk. As you said, I'm Tom Ray. Middle initial is R, which stands for trouble, according to my wife. And I'm a VP Corporate Director of Engineering of Buckley Broadcasting, WOR Radio in New York City.
Also with us tonight from Wisconsin, it is, I never can pronounce the name of the town he lives in, I think. Chris Tarr. Hi, Chris.
Well, the town, I work in Milwaukee. The village I live in is Maguanago, spelled what? With a whole bunch of letters.
Oh, you've got a McDonald's. We have a McDonald's, too.
Yeah, exactly. I'm the director of engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Milwaukee and Madison, Wisconsin.
All right. I can say Madison. I can say Milwaukee, but Maguanago?
Yikes. You got tough. It. You said it just right.
Did I? Really? Awesome. Well, here's let's go now to a city that's farther south than any of us, and it's a very nice place to be, and that's Panama City, Florida. We're talking to Charlie Wooten. Hi, Charlie.
How you doing, Kirk? Panama City, home of where Tiger Woods got his divorce the day before yesterday.
Oh, my goodness. It is it's famous for things you may not want to be famous for. Hey, Charlie, tell us about yourself. What is your work position? And then we're going to get into the conversation about amateur radio.
I'm the market engineer for Clear Channel Radio here in Panama City. We have five FMs and one AM station.
I think there is some evidence that you know what you're doing in broadcast engineering, because weren't you given some kind of nice award a couple, three, 4 years ago from Clear Channel?
Actually, I have three awards, three consecutive years. One year it was for Small Market Engineer of the Year. One year it was for Southeastern United States Engineering of the Year. And then the third one was National Engineer of the Year.
Wow. Well, congratulations. That's quite an honor. Especially, I guess that honor comes from your peers at Clear Channel, right?
Yes, it does. It comes from some kind of an informal voting or nomination process.
Cool. All right. Well, Charlie, you and I have known each other for quite some time. I don't remember how we met, but I know I've known your name for a long, long time. And when I was introduced to you, we were talking about amateur radio. Now, on the show tonight, all of the people on the show are licensed amateur radio operators, or hams. A lot easier to say ham, and nobody seems to mind that, so we'll say that. But guys like me, I'm not very active into the hobby. I just do some 2 meter and 440. I was listening to a net last night on my 2 meter rig. Once in a while, I use IRLP or Echo Link to talk to someone in a different part of the world via IP over the internet to another repeater. But we got a couple of guys on the show tonight who are much more into ham radio than I am. So, Charlie, that one would be you. Tom Ray is also an expert at this. So you two are going to kind of dominate the show tonight. And Chris, I'm sorry, I don't know how much you're into ham radio or not. I think you and I both just do some 2 meter and 440 stuff. So before the show, Charlie, I was saying that we would like for you to talk to our audience members about whatever's near and dear to your heart in amateur radio. And one thing that I know that you're big into is contesting. And that's a concept that I just, frankly, I don't understand very well. I'm not into that. So I'd like to kind of go off in that direction for a while about amateur radio contesting. So why don't you kind of take it from there, and how did you get interested in contesting?
It started back when I was in high school, actually. Maybe Tom remembers this. Tom, do you remember the old CD parties that the ARRL used to have before, back in the, I guess it was the 60s and 70s, and it was basically a little 24-hour exercise where you would try to contact as many people as you could in as many different locations or sections of the United States. You multiplied the number of contacts you made times the number of geographic sections you worked in, and that gave you your score. Well, there are all kinds of variants on that on scoring, but that's basically how you score a lot of the contest. Contesting can be very expensive. As a matter of fact, Kirk, I was at the Huntsville Ham Fest last weekend, and I went out to see a contest station just north of Huntsville that's owned by Rick K4TD, and he basically had a 199.9-foot tower in the backyard that rotates. It's a Rowan 55, but it has slip ring guy anchors on it that allow the tower to rotate. It's got a rotator at the base of the tower, and he has. I think we figured there were 69 elements on the tower, counting all of the different beams and the stacked arrays, including things like 4-element 40-meter beams and things of that nature. So you can get. I mean, he probably has 75 grand in that antenna. I mean, so it can get to be very expensive.
Let me pause you for a second there. You've said the whole tower rotates. Now, Charlie, in your shot, I'm going to ask Burke to go back to your shot. You've got a tower rotator control beyond you over there. Now, that doesn't rotate the whole tower, though. That rotates the antenna.
No. I have 70 feet of Rome 25 tower with a Mosley tribander with the what we call the workband elements. I actually got 4 elements on the beam, and then I have some wire antennas for the lower frequencies. But what I was saying is you can get contesting can be very expensive. I may have sitting here between, I've got two of these, I've got this amplifier, I've got a Henry amplifier back behind me on the floor here. I probably have $10,000, maybe $12,000 total involved in my part of the hobby, whereas some guys will have literally hundreds of thousands of dollars involved in their hobby for contesting. Yes, for contesting.
So and, okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead. And finish.
There is a contest almost every weekend. I don't get in the contest every weekend. There are about a dozen that I get into throughout the year, maybe a few more than that. A lot of what we call the Worldwide DX Contest, ARRL DX Contest, the WPX Contest, which is a deal where you try to work as many prefixes of calls. Like my call is NF4A, so I would be NF4 would be a multiplier, as I was mentioning a while ago. Your score is determined by multipliers and the number of people that you work. That's a real interesting contest to get into. And then my other part of ham radio that I'm into is DXing. And, of course, that's just working countries all over the world. And Oh, I was going to show you something in regard to contesting. You get these, I don't know if I'm getting this where you can see it.
Yeah,
this
fine.
Is a nice plaque from the ARRL for winning the sweepstakes, Southeastern Division phone in 2008. I've got another one on the wall there from 2007. And those are the kind of things that that you get. You get plaques, and I've got a few up here on the wall from different contests and whatnot. And then we have what's called DXing, and that's where you try to work all the countries. Currently, I believe the number is 336 countries officially in the world right now, or what we call entities. And you try to work all of these. And once you work these, you get on what's called the honor roll, and you're given a special award for that. Unfortunately, I'm not quite there yet. I'm at 311 countries, but I'm steadily working my way that way. There's a lot of fun doing DXing, looking for stations all over the world, because we use internet technology to post. We have what we call a packet cluster, where we actually, when you see a station on the air, or you hear a station on the air, you post it, and you put the frequency and the call sign, and of course it puts your call sign, so that you know the propagation of where that signal is coming from, and whether you'll be able to hear it. Because if a guy in Japan posts it, you probably won't be able to hear him here in the States. But if it's somebody in the Southeast United States that posts it, then I feel like I should be able to hear that guy. So I'll tune my radio to that frequency and see if I can hear him. If I can, if it's something, a new country or something that I would like to work, I turn on the radio and give him a call.
So you use the internet to give you a heads up as to where your contacts may be able to be made.
Yeah, in a lot of cases I do. Yeah, during contest, some people use the packet for finding multipliers, but that puts you into a different category, something called the assisted category, because you have to claim that assistance as a crutch, I guess you would say. Whereas if you're just a single operator, unassisted, that means you do not use the packet cluster to operate the contest.
You said there's a contest usually every weekend, a contest of some kind. I guess there's VHF and UHF contests and all different kinds of contests with different rules or themes. So tell us about the next contest that you're going to participate in and what you're going to do to prepare for that, and then what you expect to happen during that weekend contest. What will you be doing to try to maximize your standing in the contest?
Well, right now, I believe the next contest that I will be in will be the Worked All Europe phone contest. That's where the world works Europe, and that's a really unique contest. But that's basically what it is you try to work as many European stations as you can. The code or the CW portion of that contest was 2 weeks ago, and then the phone contest will be coming up, where we would use voice for that. And most of the conversations on ham radio, especially during contests, are of course in English, which is the international universal language on the radio for aircraft and whatnot.
Okay, so it's English also with ham radio. That it tends to be.
Yeah, for the most part, you do work some people during contest, and they know just enough basic English to be able to exchange whatever information needs to be exchanged for that particular contest. Some people don't call it contest, but I do, and I think some people do too. I know a lot of you people, I know Tom's familiar with this because I've seen a post from him on Facebook about it. It's the ARRL Field Day. I don't know, Tom, do you feel that Field Day is a contest, or do you think it's an operating activity?
I find it to be a... basically a lot of fun. I tend to treat it as a contest. Now, I'm not a big contester, but I do hold the distinction for my ham radio club of having the most contacts on field day this year, which is unusual. There's a couple of other guys who usually clobber everybody, but this year it was me on 15 meters. And I find it to be kind of it's a contest, but it's fun. You know, a lot of people who contest take it very seriously, and I'm not a very serious contester. I mean, my, The other contest I get involved in is the New York Radio the New York QSO party, which last year was in October, and I think should be coming up this October, but I haven't seen anything about it yet. Charlie, before when you were talking about working some foreign stations and stuff, you mentioned a packet cluster. What's your favorite URL to go to for that?
I use K1TTT, which is up in Massachusetts. I did use one down in Atlanta for a long time, but unfortunately that ham passed away and his packet went down. And so I've been using K1TTT up in Massachusetts. It's I'm trying to remember.
It's K1TTT.net is his website, and there's a web cluster link on it.
Yeah, I guess you can get it from his website. You can get the exact way. You can use your the regular Telnet program. There are also some very good free freak programs that you can the Victor Echo 7CC, VE7CC. If you do a search for that, there's a very good free packet program there, Windows based, rather than using the clumsy Telnet interface, which turns it into a Windows interface and gives you a little bit more information, and it breaks the spots down into the different bands and frequencies of so you can look at all the 40 meter spots, or you can look at all the spots if you want to, and that's a free program.
Even better. Yeah. Hams like free.
Yeah, everybody likes free. Now last weekend, y'all mentioned I was listening to the show and watching the show, and there was a mention. I think you mentioned it, Tom, about county hunting, and and that's one of the things that I have done and finished up, working all 3,076 counties. And I did this back in the early 90s. I used to work for myself, and I had various vehicles because I put a lot of miles on them and wore them out, but I was literally all over the United States doing work, thanks to 8090 and things like that. That I had built a lot of transmitter sites and studios all over the country, and so I was constantly moving around. And so I was able to not only give out counties as I was traveling around the United States, but I was also able to work counties, and because I would be driving part of the day, and there was a place where you could, a frequency called the County Hunters Net, where you could go and you could just sit and monitor, and there would be somebody with a radio in their car, and they would show up in this county, and you'd work them, and then when you came home, you'd exchange a card with them to where you would have some kind of written confirmation. And let me show you the award that you get for doing this. I don't know if it'll even show up, it's so big, but it's by CQ Magazine. Let's see. There we go. It's by CQ Magazine. The Worked All Counties Award is presented by them, and that's my award for doing that. You can get the basic award at 500 counties, and then you work the different, as you endorse it, you get the different at 500 county increments all the way up until you work all 3,076 counties. There are 3,076 counties in the United States, including the judicial districts of Alaska, which you have to work all of those, and the second judicial district in Alaska, which is on the where Prudhoe Bay and places like that. That's one of the hardest ones to get.
Now, Charlie, with your DXCC award that you're working towards, do you have to upload that to the Logbook of the World, or how do you get credit for all the countries there, and how do you prove it?
Well, that's what I'm doing, and I'm glad you mentioned Logbook of the World, because that's really a cool thing, Tom. I don't know if you use it or not. I use it extensively. I have DXCC, which is working 100 countries. That's what it's called, the DX Century Club. But I have worked, I have confirmed, I believe at this point, 271, 100% via Logbook of the World, Tom. I'm doing them separately because I want to see how many I can actually get using confirmations 100% using Logbook of the World. And let me explain to everybody what that means. Whenever you finish working a number of stations in your log, especially if you're using a computer logging program, you can upload that log to the ARRL headquarters, the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut. And they have a thing called Logbook of the World. And rather than having to send a QSL card, back and forth to get the Gambia or somewhere, Uzbekistan, rather than having to get a card back and forth. If the ham in Uzbekistan goes to Logbook of the World and uploads his log, and I've uploaded my log, and the two contacts mesh as far as time and frequency and date, then we are given confirmation of that without having to go through the expense and the time to do it with what we call a QSL card. Now, I get QSL cards in the mail almost daily, and because I get into contests a lot, I get from the ARRL QSL Bureau, it's not uncommon for me to get 2 or 3 pounds of QSL cards after a major contest through the ARRL Bureau. But it's a lot easier to do. Of course, the expense, the postage and the printing goes away. There's ARRL charges a very what I consider appropriate fee for doing the Logbook of the World, and it's almost it's instantaneous. I have uploaded after a contest, for instance. I have literally uploaded my log at the end of a contest usually at 0 hours Zulu on Sunday night. And right before that, 20 meters was open to, let's say, Taiwan, Korea, or Japan. And those guys upload theirs. And by 8 o'clock at night, by 0100 Zulu, another hour, I've got the confirmations for those contacts. I've got my so-called electronic QSL card already. So it's really cool. Tom, do you use the Logbook of the World?
No, but I've just started looked into it, and I've got the files. I just haven't started it yet, and I've wanted to talk to somebody who did. Obviously, you do. So it should be a good thing, and it sounds pretty easy. What are you using for logging software to send your log up to them?
Well, I use for logging. I use contests because I don't get on the air in what they call RagShoe. Just talk, I normally use. Normally use contest logging software. Some of that's free. There's a great program that's been around for a long time called CT. And there's a version that runs in DOS, and there's also a version that runs in Windows. There's also N1MM, November 1 Mike. That's a very good computer, and it's free. Free is good. And then I've been using a program that costs $60. It's done by some hams in France, and it's called WinTest. And I really like that program, and I use that program for as many contests as it supports, because you have to have a different template for each contest, and they don't necessarily support all of the contests that the program CT does or N1MM does. But when at all possible, I try to use WinTest because it seems to be a pretty good program.
Now, you were talking about the worked all countries. How many of the countries that you have left are actually rare and that you really have to chase and find them on the air?
Of the ones that are really rare, probably 8 or 10. There's a place called Heard Island that's down in the off of Antarctica, which I missed. I wasn't active on the air when there was some activity on Heard Island. Beauvais Island, I don't have Beauvais. That's another island in the near the Antarctica. It's a Norwegian island, I believe. But there have been hams there in the last 15 years. It's just that at the time I was not active in ham radio to where I had a decent setup to be able to work that type of DX. Now, I've I've been very active all these years, but it's been in different facets. Like in the 80s and into the 90s, I was strictly mobile, but I had a pretty good mobile setup. I had an ICOM 735, and I built an amplifier based on a Motorola applications note that used 8 MRF 454s, and it was a real headlight dimmer. It would put out about 700 watts on about 800 watts on 80 meters, about 800 watts on 40, and about 600 on 20, and it tapered down from there to about 500 watts. But and I used a Texas bug catcher for my 80 meter and 40 meter activities, and I used other antennas for the other bands. But I was able to work quite a bit of DX that way. But since 1997, I've had 1995. I've had a very good home station, and we just moved into this house here. 3 years now, and the room I'm in is what I call my man cave. It's a third garage that has its own central heat and air. It has its own workbench. It has 220 outlets, Tom, on the wall, so that when we moved in, I plugged my amplifier directly into the wall. I didn't have to go and, you know, put in outlets or anything, because the guy that had this house before, he restored Corvettes. And this was his place where he restored the Corvettes. This is where he would drive them in. There are two drains in the floor. There are I-beams on the ceiling so you can hoist out an engine if you needed to. There's a sink over there where you can wash your hands, and two big long workbenches. All of this was already in this. And my wife and I had been, looking at like 100 houses, and we walked into this one, and I told my wife, I said, "This is it. We're getting this one." Of course, I don't know if it was what she wanted, but we ended up with it, thank goodness. But I mean, it's been perfect for my ham radio, and for doing other things. You know, I hunt, and deer hunt was another one of my activities in the wintertime.
Hey Charlie, now I'm told by a mutual friend that you in 2009 participated in a de-expedition up to Midway Island.
Yeah, out to Midway Island, sure did. That was some of the best ham radio fun I've ever had.
And he tells me that you actually got into it. It was almost a last minute thing. And the big thing on our minds is, how does one get the time off from work to do that last minute?
Well, I'm gonna tell you this happened. Now this is a very true story, and it was a Wednesday night. It was our wedding anniversary.
Oh, man.
We were at an Italian restaurant, our favorite Italian restaurant we go to here, Ferrucci in Panama City. I get a phone call on my cell phone from Tom Harrell, N4XP. He's in Honolulu. He says, "Can you be in Honolulu tomorrow afternoon at 4:30? And
oh, jeez.
So I said, "Let me call you back." So I talked to Jennifer, and Jennifer said, "Hell yeah." I mean, I was completely flabbergasted, but that's basically what she said. And so I immediately, while we were eating, I was on the phone with the airlines. Of course, the airlines, if you're going somewhere the very next day, they rape you. Everybody else got their airline ticket for $700. I had to pay $1,600 for mine, you know, wow, because of the last minute deal. And of course, I had to pay my fair share of the de-expedition expenses, which was about $5,000. And I took care of that after we got back, because there just wasn't enough time. But we were able to do that. And I went. I went, and I'll have to say that I thank Randy Moore at Clear Channel in Tallahassee, AI4CO, he's a ham, and Clyde Scott, W4CCS, who's the Clear Channel engineer in Albany, Georgia. They were on call for me for any off-air problems that we had while I was gone. And I called them up, asked them. They said, "Sure, no problem," because I do the same thing for them when I can. We all swap back and forth when we need to be out of town. But at any rate, I was able to leave Panama City. I could not fly from Panama City because of the connection. I had to drive from Panama City to Atlanta to catch an American Airlines flight out of Atlanta to Dallas, so I could catch the flight to Honolulu. But I made it, and the next afternoon I was there at 4:30. And the thing of it is, I had been up the night before with a transmitter. I had a problem with a transmitter, and so I think my head hit the pillow around 4 a.m. that morning before. So I got up at about 9 And then, so I had 5 hours sleep, and then I was up, you know, for another 36 hours after that. So it was quite a, when I got, there's a picture of me in this PowerPoint that they show for the Midway Island Expedition. And I'm all bug eyed and just, as I'm, they take this picture as I walk into the lobby of the hotel in Honolulu, and the, somebody took it with their cell phone, and that's the one they used. You know, I've been trying to try to get that picture removed, but at any rate, that was a lot of fun. Now you can go to Midway. Let's see, I think it's Midway 2010.
Yeah, Midway2009.com. In fact, we got a pic. I want Burke to put this picture up. This is kind of what it's like to operate from an island. Burke, you got that picture? The relaxing by the ocean, talking on the radio picture? No, not that one. The other one. Come on, Burke. You know, the one with the guy with his feet up. There you go.
There we go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Charlie, what are we looking at here?
I'm trying to look at it. I'm across the room, but I think that's Max. I8NHJ, one of the operators. He's from Italy. Yeah, that's Max, I think. No, that's James. That's James Brooks, 9B1YC. He's operating there. That now I think this picture was taken at Scarborough Reef, if I'm not mistaken, which is basically a rock sticking out of the water in the South China Sea. Which, by the way, I worked on 20 sideband and 20 CW, so hey, I'm happy about it.
There's another picture I want to pop up, and you tell me what this map means. This is a map, Burke, the one that I just sent you. It's a great circle map, right. And I'm intrigued about a map that has where you are as the center of everything, and then shows the rest of the world in relation to that. So yeah, this map is available on that midway2009.com website. Tell us what this means.
That tells you where to point your antenna, where we would point our antenna to work a particular part of the world, and I have one. I'm sure Tom has one for his location in New York, but I have one for my location here in Florida, so that I can know where to point. And Kurt, where would you think you would need to point to talk to Japan?
You know, you'd think it'd be kind of west, but that's
about 330 degrees.
Wow. So from where Panama City in the U.S., you got to point 330 degrees, which is almost north. Okay, it's north-northwest.
Yeah.
To talk to Japan.
Where would you think you would have to point to talk to India?
Oh, golly. I'm guessing right over the North Pole.
Exactly. Due north.
Okay. Now, so
yep,
this is when I fly from Chicago to India, we just almost go over the North Pole.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, that's it. That's the way. And of course, you can have long path and short path. So, for instance, if I want to talk in the morning, early in the morning, on 20 meters, if I want to talk to Australia,
yeah,
I point my beam about 270 degrees. However, about 2:30 in the afternoon, if I want to talk to Australia, long path, which means it's not coming from the west, but it's coming from the other way over the Indian Ocean and over over the Middle East and over the Mediterranean into here, I would point my beam to the east or a little bit south of east to talk to Australia, because you can have propagation from either direction.
So you can go around the world the long way or the short way to get to where you're going.
Exactly, and it's called long path and short path.
Wow, that is just amazing. And is it by experience that you know which way to try?
Well, you know by the time of day. I know that if I'm going to talk to Australia in the middle of the afternoon, I know I don't point to the west on 20 meters. I point to the east. However, if I'm going to talk to Australia on 15 or 10 meters in the afternoon, I would point to the west. It's something you have to learn from years of being on the air and understanding propagation. It's not that big of a deal to learn, but there's little things that you learn by just spending time on the radio. For instance, right now I could turn the radio on and Europe would be blowing in here on 20 meters big time. maybe even some stuff from Japan. It's a little bit, well, let's see, I'm just looking outside. It's dark already. Right before dark here, about 6 p.m. Central Time, you could talk to Japan without any problem on 20 meters, and maybe even so on 15 meters, because as the sun's going down here, the sun is coming up in Japan, and you work what's called the gray line, which is the twilight line of where that's where the sun is coming up and going down at the same time, and you actually you propagate along the gray line rather than maybe between. Straight between the two points, you actually propagate through the gray line.
Huh. Tom, what do you know about this gray line stuff? Is that something you do?
Well, it's something I've tried to, I've been trying to get on because I haven't made an Australian contact yet, and it's something I kind of want to do. And, you know, the problem right now is I don't have a beam antenna. I'm just getting things like that up. I've got a nice little tower laying down by the side of the house, but no plans to put it up maybe until next year. But with a 130-foot dipole in the backyard, I've been able to hit Japan, and I've been able to hit the Cook Islands. So there's no reason why I shouldn't be able to hit Australia. And we did that, gosh, when did we do that? Oh, we had our club picnic a couple of weeks ago, and they ended up doing that with a 20-meter dipole.
Yeah.
So
now you know, I got Tom, I've talked to Australia before on 2 meters.
Yeah,
you were using the internet to get from here to there, though.
Oh, yes, I was. I was using the intertubes. Yeah, Chris Tarr, you've done this IRLP thing, haven't you? Isn't that fun and easy?
Well, it is. It is both, yes. And what IRLP is, it stands for Internet Repeater Linking Project, and it's a way to link 2-meter repeaters using voice over IP. Now, it's kind of controversial. You know, some people don't believe that you're really making, you know, those kind of contacts because you're using help with the internet. But it's a fun way to, you know, to pass the time and to connect with people in other countries. And, you know, it certainly doesn't beat getting up on HF and talking to these people directly over the air. But it is kind of cool to be driving around in your car, dial somebody up, and, you know, talk to a completely different country on your local 2-meter repeater. There's a couple of technologies out there now that are starting to do those sorts of things. But I think more and more you're going to see, just because a lot of these repeaters tend to not be used very often for local communication. They sit quiet, you know, and you'll see a lot of these now setting up voice over IP links to connect to other repeaters and to do a bunch of different types of linking. And it's really neat how that all works.
I would consider IRLP operation on ham radio to be kind of like a gateway drug into serious ham operation. Speaking of serious ham operation, look at that picture.
Oh yeah, that's on Midway there. Yeah,
that's on Midway Island.
Yeah,
now you look pretty comfy right there. What's that building you're in? I thought you were in a tent or something.
That is the bar. That is the old bar from the old Navy base. And we were the CW operators were operated from the bar. The guys that operated voice had to set up tents on the beach, and they operated from a couple of easy up tents and whatnot. But we operated, we had this beautiful, absolutely beautiful view looking through those windows over the vegetation onto the atoll, the water, you know, going across there, just the, you know, turquoise water, just beautiful. It's air conditioned, and it was Midway is a strange deal. It's an exotic DX location, but it isn't hard to get to if you've got the permission. And that if you've got the permission is the deal. The Fish and Wildlife Service controls every person who sets foot on that island. You do not set foot on that island without the express written consent of the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they have people there on the island to enforce that. Midway has a 9,000 or 10,000 foot runway on it, which is set up for emergencies and, you know, for the Trans-Pacific flights. And so that there is a very, you know, there's a good, well-maintained airstrip there. There is a group of about 10 Fish and Wildlife Service personnel who live there. There's some FAA personnel who live there, who maintain the control tower. And then there are some Homeland Security, U.S. military people, a few of those. And then you have a company called Chugash, which is the contractor who makes sure that there's electricity for the island. They feed the people on the island that are there working, and they maintain the infrastructure on the island. So there's electric generation, water purification, sewer, and housing. And so they maintain for people who come there to help work with the Fish and Wildlife Service on trying to put the island back to its original state before the military got a hold of it. And so they have a lot of volunteers that come there and help try to get rid of any vegetation that is not native to the island. There's the beautiful gold flowers that are all over the island, but they weren't supposed to be there. They got there when the Navy wives brought them there when there was a big Navy base. There used to be 5,000 people on Midway Island.
Yeah.
But at any rate, we had to get special permission to go to the island. And there's another thing. You've heard of the Goonie Birds, I guess.
Yeah, heard of that. Okay. What is that?
Well, the Goonie Birds are these big albatross who 9 months out of the year make Midway Island their home. And you literally cannot walk around without stepping on one. There are literally hundreds of thousands of these birds on the island. And they're very large. They have like a 7-foot wingspan. They start coming in late October, and over a period of just a few weeks, they show up, and they're all there, and they're there for 2.5 to 3 months, and then they fly away. No, I'm sorry, they're there for 9 months, and then they fly away and don't come back until the following October. So we had to time our de-expedition to be there just in time before the birds got there, so that we could leave before the birds came back to the island. One bird, the day we left, one bird had come back. One single bird had come back.
He was a scout, huh?
Yeah, I guess he was a scouter. He says, oh, man, I missed a party, or I'm too early for the party. But at any rate, we made
What's this picture we're looking at here? What are these antennas on the beach?
Those are a vertical dipole arrays that we use strictly vertical dipoles because the fish and wildlife people did not want us to use Yagis because of the birds. And if notice, I don't know if you can see it in the picture very well or not, but there's a lot of flagging on the antenna and on the guy wires so that the birds would see that and would stay away from. Luckily, no birds were injured during our de-expedition. But we had a number of these verticals up on the beach, all with ground radials and everything. We had everything from 160 meters to 10 meters. 160 meters, by the way, is just above the broadcast band. It starts at 1.8 megahertz. And we were working stations in the States without any problem at all. We were working stations in Europe on 160 meters without any problem at all. And if you think about that, just on the high end of the broadcast band, and we were running a kilowatt. That's all we were running. So
I want to go back and ask you a question about these far out of the way islands that are part of contesting or part of getting to the 336 countries or entities, right. and make sure I didn't miss something here. But these you talked as a ham radio operator. You talked to islands where normally nobody lives there. There's no ham radio operators. There's nobody there unless an expedition goes there.
Right. The expedition goes there. Like I was mentioning a while ago, Heard Island, Desecheo Island, which is off of Puerto Rico, Navassa Island, which is down near Puerto Rico. All of those are called DX entities. And in the case of those two islands, again, they're controlled by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And so there was a group that went to Desecheo last year, and I think there's a group planning to go to Navassa sometime in the next year or two.
This picture here, now there's a plane load of ham there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had to literally rent a plane, and we had it was a Grumman G1, which was a turboprop. It held 20 people, and that's what we used to go to and from the island. And it was the plane itself was $2,000 per person. That's what it cost per person for that the expeditions are not. Not cheap things to happen. And of course, we had radios, we had amplifiers. We paid a contractor $6,000 to put us in some additional electrical We took some Hoffman, you know, some of those Hoffman outdoor rated boxes, and we had plugs put in them down on the beach where we could power our stations, so we didn't have to worry about having to go in and spend a bunch of time tapping into electrical. We actually just had new circuits put in before we got to the island, so they were there. Of course, when you're going to an island with no electricity, you bring generators and whatnot.
You know, something like this sounds like a vacation for rich geeks. It's a lot of money to go.
It's a lot of money to go, but it's not. Some of those de-expeditions can be inexpensive. There's a group that just went to Dry Tortugas, which is and I don't think that was very expensive. Of course, there's a boat that you get on to go to Dry Tortugas, but according to where it is and what it happens is you get the ham community all over the world, and now with PayPal and things, and they donate. And you have there are DX clubs all over the world that donate money. And so in addition to the money that you put into it, you have hams all over the world donating to your cause so that you have enough to get the job done and get it done right. And next month, I'm going on another one. But this one will be to St. Martin, Dutch St. Martin, on 10-10-10, October 10 of 2010, Dutch St. Martin, which is now uses PJ7 as their prefix, like we use W and K in the United States and N and whatnot. Their prefix is PJ7. They become an independent country. They will no longer be part of the Dutch Empire, Dutch Antilles or Netherlands Antilles. And so, as far as countries are concerned, on the tenth of October, they will be a new country.
So
there's a group of us that are going down. A lot of the guys that went to Midway are the same group, some newer guys as well, but we're going down to operate from St. Martin, we've rented a top, I think, I maybe have some of these details not exactly right, but I think I have it. We basically have the top floor of one condo there rented for our radio operations where we could put antennas. We've got another house down a couple of miles away we're going to use one location for code and one location for sideband. You don't want to put them close together because they will interfere with each other. You want to separate them as much as possible. On Midway, we were about 1,000 feet apart. This voice and the CW stations were about 1,000 feet apart, and we were trying to. You have to separate them because you begin to have intermod, and you have problems with the receivers desensing and things like that from all the RF floating around. But we're going to St. Martin, and that's going to be coming up, and I'm looking forward to that. And my wife gets to go to that. It's payback time for Midway.
Hey, Charlie, now I noticed one of the advertisers on the website that's about your 2009 de-expedition is another website called dxworld.net. And I was just taking a quick look at this. There are a lot of interesting things here about, you know, where people are going on various de-expeditions and where people are. You can contact them. Tell us about this dx-world.net.
There are all kinds of organizations who put out news and information. And of course, the internet has just made it so much easier. Years ago, you had people who put out little mimeographed or copied newsletters, you know, and mailed them once a week about so-and-so is going to this place and you need to listen for this person. They're going to be here. And of course, now with the internet, it's immediate and a lot less expensive, but there's that group. A group called Bernie W3UR has a DX bulletin that he puts out. N4AA Carl up in North Carolina, he has a bulletin that he puts out each week and each day about DX. There's a lot of these things and a lot of these places where you can get information on activities that are upcoming.
What I'm going to say right now is no news at all to ham radio regulars and enthusiasts. But for those of many people who are not in our audience who are not ham radio enthusiasts, here's a message in the chat room from Darth Emma. It says, I'm a geologist and did field work in Antarctica in the 1980s. We had to use ham radio operators to connect us to talk to our families in the U.S. So, Charlie, what Charlie or open this up to either Tom or Chris, too. What kind of work do ham radio operators do to help people talk to each other who otherwise could not?
That's a good, I'm glad you brought that up, Kirk, because it's an integral part of ham radio, and it's what keeps ham radio going as far as our importance, and as far as whenever our frequencies are up for grabs or people try to do a grab on our frequencies. We do a lot of emergency communications during like Hurricane Katrina. There was all kinds of things that happened by ham radio because a lot of the radio systems were down and some ham radio systems stayed up. But phone patch, what we call a phone patch is what she's talking about there. There are many stations in Antarctica, all the different countries that have stations, exploratory stations in Antarctica usually have an amateur station because it seems to that they can get out on the ham radio when perhaps the government radio is not working. Of course, that's changed a little bit here recently with some of the new satellite technology. But when they were strictly depending on HF and high frequency propagation and whatnot, a lot of times the HF ham frequencies were some of the more ideal frequencies to be able to talk to. I've talked to Antarctica many times on many different occasions, and and I remember when during the Vietnam War, I used to do phone patches from Vietnam. I would get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and do phone patches through another thing called Mars. I don't know if we want to get into that, but it's a military part of ham radio. And yeah. I used to do phone patches for people in Vietnam for U.S. soldiers when they were in Vietnam. All kinds of things to do with emergency communications. We help with here locally, the local hams here help with the communications for the Florida Ironman, which is done here, the race. You know, the communications for making sure that all of the aid stations have enough supplies, or if somebody has a wreck, or if they need medical attention or whatever. We're able to, because of our wide area repeaters that we have, we're able to communicate on my tower. I've got 1,150. Well, I say I do. Crown Castle has an 1,150-foot tower that Clear Channel uses for two of our main FM stations here in Panama City, and I have 800 feet up on that tower, a 6 meter, a 2 meter, and a 440 repeater.
Wow!
But we have a $1 a year lease with Crown Castle. Which was orchestrated by our local county emergency management, because we're such an integral part of their communications plan when it comes to hurricanes in this area. We do all the communications for all the Red Cross shelters and that type of thing, and so we were able to work this out with Crown Castle with this lease, a dollar a year lease for our ham repeaters to be up on that tower.
I know we've got people watching or listening who are interested in checking this hobby out, or perhaps they're like me. They have a license. I have a basic, no code technician's license, and may be interested in taking the next step. So what, Charlie, I mean, you're the expert here with all the contesting and DXing you've done. I mean, you see a very wide view of ham radio, even though you probably don't participate in everything that can be done in ham radio when you get to satellites and all the packet communications modes and things like that. Where should people go to get started? And is it really beneficial to make friends with a ham radio operator to show you the ropes, as opposed to just reading about it on the internet and buying a license course and buying a radio? Where should people go to get started?
Well, a lot of communities have ham radio clubs, and a lot of these same communities, the clubs have classes, and they also give the exams. One of the things that's recently come up in the last couple of years you had to know the Morse code to become a ham operator. You mentioned no code a while ago. Well, yeah. Now you don't have to have you don't have to know the Morse code to have any class of license. I have mixed feelings about that being an extra class licensee, but It doesn't. You're not required to have the code anymore. I enjoy code. I enjoy Morse code. I probably operate 70% of the time on Morse code, 30% of the time on voice. But at any rate, the code used to be the big problem with people learning to the stuff to get on ham radio. But now that you don't have to have the code, it's really not that bad. You can get the study guides on the internet. There are you can, like I said, contact your local ham club. You can contact the American Radio Relay League. It's ARRL.org, ARRL.org. And they can give you the name of a club in your area. Most of these clubs, like I said, give the exams and also have classes to teach you the things you have to know to get the license. And we have these wonderful things called HamFest, it's basically a convention of hams. I go to several a year, and one of the ones that I go to is in Dayton, Ohio. I go every year. It's about 30,000 hams from all over the world, not just the United States. I just went to one in Huntsville, Alabama this past weekend, which was a great ham fest. And if you hear about a ham fest, you can go to one of those, and there's always someone there at that ham fest that can help you from the local club who organizes a ham fest. And they give the exams at the ham fest. So it's very simple. And one of the things I wanted to talk about, and I forgot to, and I want to do it before we run out of time, Kirk, is the number of famous people who have been hams. You know, there are large numbers of people who are hams that you would never expect that they were hams. You know, the great guitarist, Eddie Arnold, he was a ham. Did you know that?
Nope, didn't know that.
Okay, Eddie Arnold, Arthur Godfrey, the old radio, CBS radio host.
Yeah, I did hear that, yeah.
Yeah.
Some of the astronauts have been hams because they've operated from the space station.
Most of the astronauts that have been on the space station, I would say 90% of them even, both Russian, Japanese, whatever, French, American, all of those have been hams. There is a packet station on that you can work when it's on the space station. It operates all the time, and it's an unmanned. It's like a robot. It will talk to you and confirm that it heard you. But all you got to do is just listen for it, and you can hear it. It's amazingly strong. When that sucker comes straight overhead, it can be 20 and 30/9, which is a really strong signal with just a basic antenna. Barry Goldwater, the senator, he was a ham. There are all kinds of people you never would guess would be a ham. Joe Walsh, the rock and roll guy.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, and Joe's friend Walter Cronkite.
Bob Howe. Yeah, Walter Cronkite.
And WR's claim to fame, and I had it on the tip of my tongue, and now I'm pulling a blank on it. He wrote A Christmas Story.
Oh, I know. Gene Shepherd.
Gene Shepherd, yes. He was a ham and talked about it quite frequently and used to talk on the ham radio between breaks.
Yeah, I've heard of him. Of course, we have people today I'm sure you've all heard of Rick and Bubba, you know, Bubba.
Oh yeah. Everybody south of the Mason-Dixon line, I think is probably.
Yeah. Bubba is KJ4JJ. He's KJ4JJ. He's very active. We have 100, by the way, I am the keeper of the list for all the hams at Clear Channel. There are 153 hams at Clear Channel. I don't know if anybody, that's a little trivia there. There are 153 different hams employed by Clear Channel. They're not all engineers. Probably 80% are engineers, but we've had regional vice presidents, not engineering vice presidents, but regional vice presidents for the areas, for stations in the south. The late Dave Reinhart, he just died here a couple of months ago. He was a ham, we have a lot of people in Clear Channel that are hams. Like I said, 80% are are in the engineering area, but we have others that are jocks. We have I know there's one guy who's at the help desk in San Antonio when we have a IT problem or something, and we need to call the help desk. He's one of the guys that answers the phone at the help desk in San Antonio.
Well, Charlie, you're going to appreciate this. My ham club starting in September will be giving ham classes again. We've done this several times and usually have 100% success rate. But I've been bugging my wife and I've been bugging my daughter and bugging my son and said, you guys really need to get your license just for fun. My wife said, fine, I'll do it. If I do it, you learn to quilt. So we have a little wager going.
Hey guys, we're gonna have to wrap the show up pretty soon. We've been going about an hour, but here's a favor. There's a website. We'll stick the link in the show notes. There's a website with famous hams. I just read your governor of New York, George Pataki, is K2 Zulu Charlie Zulu.
Is a ham. I did not know that.
Well, we'll post the link on the website. Hey, Chris Tarr had a parting comment. Chris, what'd you have for us?
Oh, I just going back to the radio thing this weekend. I'm going to be signing on a brand new FM non-com over in Western Wisconsin. So we're pretty excited about that. I'm bringing out the TDR and the spectrum analyzer every day and go through the proof and turn it on for the first time. So I always get a kick out of that. Turning on a brand new radio station. So I'm looking forward to that.
That's a great feeling to crank something on for the first time, a station that's never been there before. Yeah.
I got to do that a lot during 80-90 back in the 80s. When the dock at 80-90, there were I did a lot of that back then.
Yeah.
Yep, yeah. I love it a lot. And then this is it's a great community group. Saved up the money to do it and got the license going and, kind of a little bit of a deal to get it done. So, looking forward to helping them out.
Hey, another famous ham, Ronnie Millsap.
Oh yeah, I've talked to Ronnie.
Have you?
I've talked to Ronnie. Yeah, he used to hang. We had a group that used to hang around on 3898 on 75 meters at night, and it was one of the groups when I was driving all over the United States. That's where I would hang out at night. It would keep me awake, save my life, I'm sure, because I'd be driving from 300 or 400 miles, and Ronnie used to be one of the guys that would jump in there and be in there with us.
Wow. Hey, Tom, you got any parting thoughts for us? We're going to have to go shortly.
No, it's been a very interesting show, and I'd like to thank Charlie. It's been a lot of fun, and maybe one of these days when I grow up, I'll get to go to one of these AD expeditions too, because that sounds like a hoot. Really does.
That does. And Hamfest, a local Hamfest. Charlie, you mentioned you were in Huntsville, Alabama recently, and we talked about this last week. You can find a list of Hamfests on the ARRL.org website if you want to see if there's something near you. And they're in almost all the states and plenty of them during the summertime. So it's a good time to look and spend a few hours at a Hamfest in a city near you.
Yeah, they're all up. They're actually all during the year, probably not as many, of course, in November, December, January, but... But there are, starting in February all the way through October, there are a bunch of ham fests all over the country.
Yep. Hey, thanks for all the comments from the chat room. Charlie Wooten, thank you for being with us from Panama City, taking an hour out of your evening. Say hi to the wife for us, and be sure you spend some time with her. Don't stay in your man cave the whole time. Gets most of us in trouble. Yeah. Tom Ray, thanks for being with us from the Hudson Valley of New York. Appreciate you.
Hey, but yeah, try this in English now. You bet, Kirk. We'll see you next week.
And Chris Tarr, hey, thank you for being with us. And you, like me, one of the, just dabble in the hobby a little bit and know enough to know what a call sign is.
I do a lot more. I'm certainly not near as hardcore as these guys. But, I do some IHF. I do a lot of APRS, a lot of the digital stuff. So, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's very cool. Hey, in the chat room, and if you want to go to the website, thisweekinradiotech.com, let us know what you want us to talk about in terms of audio, radio technology. We've had a couple of shows here about amateur radio, devoted the whole shows to them. But we'll be back on some other topics. In fact, in the next week or two, we're going to have the new president of the Society of Broadcast Engineers, Vinnie Lopez, is going to be our guest. And also Barry Thomas, who is the outgoing president of the SBE, is going to be a guest, I hope, on an upcoming show. show. Gee, I haven't asked him yet. I'm speaking for him. So we'll see how that goes. Vinny has said yes, though. And if you have a suggestion for a guest, someone who's an engineering luminary or big in the world of audio design, engineering, transmitter design or engineering, let us know. You can go to the website, thisweekinradiotech.com, and leave your comments in the forum, or you can also leave comments on individual shows. So thanks for being with us. You can download this show in the iTunes store. You can subscribe to it there. You can also listen to it just on the website, thisweekinradiotech.com. And there's an RSS feed available, too, for any other reader or podcatcher type of program you may have. Thanks for being with us. We appreciate you listening and always love to hear your feedback. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
That's all the bandwidth we can pill for this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store.
Soliciting is strictly encouraged.
If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LePay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.